your hands up for the Hemingway List podcast, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Hope you got those hands up. I hope you are sitting there listening to a podcast with your arms extended into the air. That's what I hope for. What are we talking about today? Chapter 9? No, that's not right, is it? I've opened the wrong one. Chapter 10. Hey, before we dive into that, 5 hours ago, Simply Productive submitted something totally unrelated. So it isn't related to the Hemingway List or to Tolstoy, but if anyone is curious about yet another read-along, I need a bit of help organizing the Second Age read-along over at r/Tolkien fans. I volunteered to help, and it is clear that everyone is burnt out. If any of you have read History of Middle-earth, I could use some assistance. See my post-history for details. I have not read History of Middle-earth, but there you go. If anyone wants to get involved in some Middle-earth, some Tolkien, that's the place to go, r/Tolkien fans. Go and help out Simply Productive with that little mission going on over there. We are talking about Part 4, Chapter 10. What did this conversation reveal to you about these characters? Just a few footnotes from PNV, if anyone is interested. From the previous chapter, but brought up again in this one, Attic Salt. Refined wit, thought to be typical of Athenian conversation, as represented in many dialogues of classical and Hellenistic literature. From this chapter, Education Disputes. In 1871, the Russian Minister of National Education, Count D.A. Tolstoy, proposed establishing two sorts of schools, so-called real high schools and classical gymnasiums. The distinction was intended to limit the teaching of natural science, which was seen as a source of dangerous materialistic and atheistic notions. It was hoped that classical studies would cure young people of revolutionary ideas. Anti-nihilistic, the term nihilism first used philosophically in German, Nihilismus, to signify annihilation, a reduction to nothing, attributed to Buddha, or the rejection of religious beliefs and moral principles, came via the French nihilisme to Russian, where it acquired a political meaning referring to the doctrine of the younger generation of socialists in the 1860s, who advocated the destruction of the existing social order without specifying what should replace it. The great Russian lexicographer V.I. Dahl, normally a model of restraint, defines nihilism in his Interpretive Dictionary of the Living Russian Languages as an ugly and immoral doctrine which rejects everything that cannot be palpated. Women's education in the 1860s, women were allowed education only as teachers or midwives, but by the 1870s, women's struggles for intellectual and social independence had been clearly expressed, and higher studies in many fields were opened to them. I nearly misread the word opened. Opponed. Appened. Appended. Part 1, Note 26. Some sort of courses in 1872, a school of continuing education for women was opened in Moscow, where girls with high school diploma could study literature, history, art history, and the history of civilization, foreign languages, physics, mathematics, and hygiene. Long hair, short. The full saying is long on hair, short on brains. I think in my footnote in my version it said long hair, short wits. Very cool. The idiom actually said something like, a woman's hair is long but her wit is short, or something like that. Swim said the mama fishy said the discussion over which is better, classical education, for example, Latin, Greek, philosophy and literature, or a natural scientific education, astronomy, botany and sciences, was interesting. We can see this playing out today concerning the debate between STEM, science, technology, engineering, math, and humanities degrees. I have a BS and MS in civil engineering and spent my whole career in this field of study, which gave me a very well monetarily compensated life, but my heart has always been with the humanities. Plus my dad, best dad ever, was a civil engineer, so there was that. Fun story, I had a colleague who had a BA in history with a concentration in the British Victorian age. He went back to school and got a BS in civil engineering because of money. The other conventional, don't get me started, engineers always thought it was a little weird, which they found disconcerting and would complain about him, bless their hearts. Once I explained his educational background, a light bulb went off and all their complaining ceased in their minds. Yeah, he was still weird, but now they knew why. I am Norwegian, said. What surprised me most was Dolly chiming in, completely unsympathetic to Levin's hypothetical of a woman without family. Otherwise, I think everyone stayed very in character, especially the prince, who just wanted to make people laugh. And sure, I wouldn't mind helping out with the moderator duties. Oh, how do I do that? How do I make you a moderator? I'll do that right now on the air. Invite moderator. Oh, that's easy. Highlight your name, copy that, paste it into there, add. Done. You have been added or invited. Join the team. Look, there's not much to do as a moderator on this subreddit. I'll be honest, all that Techrific really did was pick up the slack when I would mess something up, which I occasionally did. Forgot to post the thing or post the wrong link or this and that. But yeah, they're not exactly a rowdy crowd here at the Hemingway List. You won't have to moderate any users. I don't think we've really ever had to do a ban or anything like that. So, or even anything. Yeah. Where was I up to? Ander says, Swim said the mum of fishy. Per your podcast, I'm afraid that you have missed some vital modern trends. Bingo has enjoyed a resurgence among the young crowd. Wow, really? I must have missed this. Bingo is the latest old school pastime, enjoying a resurgence among young people, along with knitting, bowling, and euchre. I don't even know what that is. Euchre. E-U-C-H-R-E. Is a trick-taking card game. It's a card game, okay. That's all I needed to know. from the London-based Underground Rebel Bingo Club, which throws wild, impromptu bingo parties around the world, to a version in Philadelphia involving drag queens on roller skates, to Cosmic Bingo, played under blacklight, Bingo is crawling out of its recreation center past. I'm googling Underground Rebel Bingo Club. Google images. It looks like a nightclub. Oh my god. Okay. That's I suppose you've got me there. Bingo is for young people now, apparently. Nifty Riffix says, things are a little backwards here, so kids are allowed in the local bingo hall, which is as smoky as a bar room. I've been going to bingo since I was a kid. I used to frequent the bingo hall as a teen because winning $125 was big money. My first date was with my husband was at the bingo hall. My work also hosted a black tie bingo with a multi-course dinner for a fundraiser to build a new hospital. It was great. My dad was the president of a football club, the local football club, the Wonthaggi Blues, for most of my childhood, I would say, up until even my early adulthood, early 20s, he was still the president. And part of being the president of a local football club is he had to do a lot of the fundraising himself. So he would sell raffle tickets at the local market on weekends, or sit in the street selling the raffle tickets. He dedicated a lot of time. Like he ran a business as well, so he had full-time work, but he also, every single week, he would go out and volunteer to sell raffle tickets. And the other thing that he did, and every Sunday, I believe it was call bingo at the local RSL, and the funds went towards the football club. And being a kid with nothing much to do, going to stay with my dad for the weekend, every second weekend, I would go and hang out at Wiley called Bingo and just, you know, get a pub squash or a Coca-Cola and help him with the old ladies playing bingo. It was always old ladies, 99% of the crowd. And they were all retirees, like they were all old people. There was not anyone under 60 in the crowd. So hey, I know my bingo. I've been to my share of bingo. I've helped. I've gone out and taken the prizes and collected the tickets and all that to help that out. That's a really boring story. I apologize for all of the last 2 minutes of me talking. Simply Productive said this. Always love the traditional thought that women are too stupid to do anything but breed and cook. You love that thought? The topics of politics and philosophy and all of that is interesting. And of course I find it funny that the one time the woman does speak in the room, it doesn't exactly prove the men wrong. Mind you, I would be very incoherent if I were constantly being accused of being stupid. So I understand how she responds out of frustration. But in general, aside from the outdated views and even the quip about men breastfeeding at the end, the dinner seems to have been a rousing success. First off, you have delicious food, but also some very good conversation. And no one being a rabble-rouser. Not really, at least. All in all, a success. Well done on a successful dinner, hey? It's funny to read these, like, that's the conversation of the day, and how hesitant people are to change. Even changes that now it's just like, you know, just get on with it when you look back in retrospect. But people really analyze a change before it happens, and they think, oh, hang on, if we change this one thing and let women study, oh, the whole society might crumble. You know, we might be messing with our very foundation as a society. I think they overthink it just slightly. It's like, hey, you know what? They're just going to learn some things. They'll just learn things. It's not that big of a deal. Learning maths or freaking whatever. Some stuff. We still do that today, though, probably, don't we? Like, things that we analyze way too deep. When it's just like, just get on with it. I think the one that comes to my mind is the whole self-driving car debate about, like, which person will the car choose to kill, and it's not up to the driver. And it's just like, I think you might be missing the point. Those cars will save hundreds of thousands of lives. They won't just be going out and choosing people to kill. It's so frustrating. But people get hung up on that. But no, but the computer gets to choose. And they also seem to think that, like, if there's a crash happening and the car's like, ooh, I can either swerve out of the way and kill that pedestrian or swerve into the other car. And it's like, well, like, it's not like a car's just going to be like, ooh, we're in an accident, quick, choose someone to kill. And in every accident, it just tries to kill someone. It will use its superior, far superior computer brain to figure out the best way out of the crash so that no one gets hurt. And I think it will do that better than a person could do it. So it will minimize the chance that someone will get killed in a crash. That's better. Right? And it also has all these sensors that humans don't have. It's got infrared and sonar and all this stuff. So radar, I don't know what cars have, but they know what's around them in 360 degrees, where we can just see what's ahead of us. They can also sense what their tires are doing, what their brakes are doing. We've just got to rely on instinct in the moment. Anyway, I'm clearly getting sidetracked, but we get caught up in these questions of, like, how should we proceed? Or no, we're about to burn the whole world down by making this one little change. And I think they might be focusing or overthinking it a little bit, focusing on the wrong thing. Getting caught up in the whole drama of the debate. Anyway, let's read chapter 11. That'll shut me up. Everybody took part in the general conversation except Kitty and Levin. At first, when the influence of one nation on another was being talked about, thoughts of what he had to say on the subject involuntarily came into Levin's mind, but these thoughts, formerly so important to him, now only flickered through his mind as in a dream, and were not of the slightest interest. It even struck him as strange that they should care to talk about things that could make no difference to anyone. In the same way, what was being said about the rights and the education of women should have interested Kitty. How often she had thought about that question when she remembered her friend abroad and the irksome state of dependence in which Varenka lived. How often she had wondered what would be her own fate if she did not get married, and how many times she had argued about it with her sister. But now it did not interest her at all. She and Levin were carrying on their own separate conversation, and it was not even a conversation, but a kind of mystic intercourse, which every moment bound them closer and closer and created in both a feeling of joyful fear before the unknown upon which they were entering. They began by Levin's telling Kitty in answer to her question of how he could have seen her in the carriage in the summer, how he was going back from the hayfield along the high road and met her. "It was early in the morning. I expect you had only just woken up. Your mother was asleep in her corner. It was a lovely morning. I was going along and wondering who that could be in a four-horsed coach, a splendid team with bells, and for an instant you appeared and I saw you at the window sitting like this, holding the strings of your cap with both hands and thinking very deeply about something," he said and smiled. "How I wish I knew what you were thinking about, something important." Was I not very untidy, she thought, but seeing the rapturous smile which the recollection of these details evoked, she felt that the impression she had produced was a very pleasing one. She blushed and laughed joyously. "I really don't remember." "How pleasantly Turovsin laughs," said Levin, looking with pleasure at his moist eyes and shaking body. "Have you known him long?" asked Kitty. "Why, who does not know him?" "I see you think he is a bad man." "Not bad, but a mere cipher." "He is not. Change your opinion quickly," said Kitty. "I, too, did not think much of him, but he is. He is a dear fellow, and a wonderfully kind-hearted one. He has a heart of gold." "How did you manage to find out his heart?" "He and I are great friends. I know him very well. Last winter, soon after you came to us," she said with a penitent and at the same time a trustful smile, "Dolly's children all had scarlet fever, and he happened to call. And fancy," she went on in a whisper, "he was so sorry for her that he stopped and helped her to nurse the children. Really, he stayed 3 weeks in the house and looked after the children like a nurse. I am telling Konstantin Dmitrich about Turovsin and the scarlet fever," she said, leaning over toward her sister. "Yes, it was wonderful. He is splendid," said Dolly, looking toward Turovsin, who felt that he was being talked about, and giving him a gentle smile. Levin looked at Turovsin again and wondered how it was he had failed to realize what a charming man he was. "I'm very sorry, very sorry. I shall never again think ill of anyone," he said merrily, expressing what he sincerely felt at the moment. All right, there we go. That's how that chapter goes. Oh man, I gotta say, recently it's been a little bit in one ear and out the other with these chapters. I'm just not soaking it in. It's probably me, not the book. It's probably a symptom of just being very tired every time I read. I really should remedy that. Anyway, have your say about this chapter over on the subreddit. I hope you enjoy your day. See you tomorrow.